Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found, but...
Yes, we did. We started digging into the ground and we started to burn many things we found. That's the wonderful Dara Williams singing with Pete Seeger and David Burns, the Solartopia song. We're back for another Solartopia Green Power Wellness Show. We got a great guest with us, Jay Warmke, the author of When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine. Jay, you're there.
Yeah, I sure am, and I'm here with my wife, Annie, as well.
Excellent, excellent. It'll be a family affair here. I do want to talk first, as I usually do at the top of the hour, about the latest developments in nuclear power. We're finding more and more horrific stuff coming out of Fukushima. As all my listeners know, we are still under the sword of Damocles of Fukushima. The reactor spent fuel pool for Unit 4 is still flying in the air at 100 feet. The TEPCO, the owners of Fukushima, did remove two unused fuel rods from the spent fuel pool and did it successfully, apparently. We had hoped that they were going to speed up the process of removing these fuel rods, because if that, God forbid, another earthquake shall hit soon, and we know that there will be other earthquakes at the Fukushima site, but if another earthquake hits soon enough, it could bring down spent fuel pool from Unit 4, thanks to the geniuses from General Electric who designed reactors where spent fuel pools will be 100 feet in the air. I don't know what drugs these guys are taking, but that's not a good one. And we now have over 1,300 fuel rods, the most highly radioactive materials ever conceived or produced by human beings, flying in the air. If, God forbid, that fuel pool would fall down, the radiation released would exceed by thousands of times the amount that was released at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And there would be a serious question about whether the human race would survive. We are already seeing elevated death rates, infant death rates in the United States, timed to the arrival of the radioactive clouds from Fukushima. The accident is by no means over. The worst part of it, as I say, is this fuel pool flying in the air. And we had hoped that TEPCO would accelerate the very careful removal of these fuel rods, one by one, two by two, however they got to do it. But apparently they're taking their time. We have a massive anti-nuclear movement, which has arisen in Japan. There was one before, but people are marching by the tens of thousands to prevent more reactors from going online. Unfortunately, there's a pro-nuclear prime minister right now in Japan, put in there by the corporations who are trying to protect their interests in nuclear power. And it's a nightmare. Here in the United States, there's considerable activity over the proposed merger of Duke Power with Progress Energy. It involves a number of nuclear plants, a really great reactors. I try not to use the word plant when describing nuclear power reactors, so I do slip up from time to time, but I try to keep it to reactors. I don't want to besmirch our green-feathered friends here. But the merger of Duke with Progress Energy has been very controversial and involves a lot of manipulation, financial manipulation, especially where it concerns the Crystal River reactor, which Progress Energy wasted $2 billion trying to fix, poked four holes in the or cracks in the containment, and it's a total nightmare. And the merger with Duke would allow Progress to be swallowed by Duke and to force ratepayers in North and South Carolina to eat these horrific costs at Crystal River. And a really good group called NC Warren has been fighting that. I've posted some articles on that at the nukefree.org website, and I hope you all take a look. We are also seeing, unfortunately, going back to Fukushima, well, some little news also. There was a plan for an Egyptian reactor. That's been canceled, thankfully. But South Korea, China, and India remain apparently committed to nuclear power, and that's where the real action is going to be, as well as here in the United States. One other thing here, they're actually having a very hard time finding enough people to work at Fukushima. I mean, who would want to, for God's sakes? There is a shortage of skilled workers to deal with the horrific disaster. I guess there aren't that many suicidal people left in Japan. And we've also, there's serious evidence now that the operators and subcontractors at Fukushima knowingly underestimated the amounts of radiation that have been released. And, of course, the children in the area are already showing signs of serious radiation poisoning. It continues to be an apocalyptic tragedy. And until we shut the rest of the reactors on this planet, nobody is safe. Now, getting to our wonderful guests, Jay and Annie Warnke. Jay, you are author of How the Biomass Hit the Mass Hit the Wind Turbine. I put up a review that seemed to have made the rounds to Huffington. Common Dreams, freepress.org, of course, where it originated. I made it my blog at www.nukefree.org. Tell us about this book, When the Biomass Hit the Wind Turbine. What's it about? Why'd you write it? Who published it? And first of all, tell us what your website is.
Our website is www.bluerockstation.com. And
where did you get that name, Blue Rock Station?
Well, Blue Rock Station is actually, it began as a sustainable living center for Annie and myself, really just a place for us to live. But when we began building a house here out of tires and cans and bottles, one of the earth ships, if people are familiar with that term, people began showing up and literally began showing up by the thousands here in southeastern Ohio. So,
well, we all know what a tourist mecca southeastern Ohio is.
Yes,
right?
Yes, we're surprising. In the middle of Disneyland of Appalachia.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so anyway, Blue Rock is our region here. Blue Rock actually is the slate that was mined in this region long ago, and a station, we just like the term. It's like a New Zealand or an Australian farm, so that's where that came from. And here at Blue Rock Station, we have a lot of interns, and I was surprised, just as you were talking about with nuclear energy, how pessimistic the young people were coming here to spend weeks or months with us here at Blue Rock Station. And they had this sense that all of their options were closed, you know, that the world was essentially going to hell in a handbasket kind of thing, and they had no opportunities, that all their horizons were shut down to them. And I could not help feeling this pessimism was, you know, I didn't know if it was misplaced or if it was actual. So I began looking into really studying in depth the fossil fuel issue, because so much of it surrounded fracking and mountaintop removal and of course, nuclear devastation from the various plants. And the more I looked into it, the more I felt like I had to understand it from a historical perspective as well. And what's fascinating to me is the deeper you dig into the whole history of fossil fuels, which is not that long of history, only really about 120 years, the more con men and charlatans and really amazingly interesting characters pop up. It got me thinking when you were speaking about GE and the subsidization of essentially technologies of desperation like nuclear and mountaintop removal, how this industry has constantly gone between begging government for support and screaming that government needs to stay off their backs from regulation.
Yeah, well, let's look at that from a contemporary point of view. There's a lot of history in your book, and we'll get to that in a short period of time. But we do have this contradiction, these so-called rugged individualists, these Ayn Rand types. And by the way, Ayn Rand, the author of The Fountainhead and the pioneer of all this so-called rugged individualism.
And right, our brave new world.
Hating, hating government and all this stuff. Ayn Rand did go on Medicare in her later life. And, you know, total hypocrite. But at any rate, tell us the current state of this ridiculous contradiction where these guys hate the government and then always turn around and take subsidies and make a fortune off the taxpayer.
Right. Well, I mean, it's just a constant, as you say. And one thing I like to say when I'm out speaking on this is that at the moment, the only reason why fossil fuels are competitive with renewable energy is because of government subsidies.
Well, how is that? Explain that. For example, let's go one by one. Let's get the oldest one first, coal. How is coal supported by government subsidies?
Well, so many of the, if you talk about their distribution processes, such as over the roadways and how the various leases that they're given on government lands, for instance, most of the coal production has moved to the western U.S., and they're given amazingly lucrative leases to mine the coal on government property, on our property, without essentially paying a fair market value for it. So just from the extraction process, you would see a tremendous subsidization of that directly to the coal power plant or to the coal power companies. If you move on, for instance, to
so
oil.
So you mean they're making these private guys, these big right-wing back to the, you know, basics of Adam Smith, who was, by the way, a progressive guy. If you ever read Adam Smith, you'd know that he actually would detest a lot of these so-called free market capitalists.
Sure.
But are you saying that these big coal barons are making, that they don't actually own the coal that they're digging?
For the most part, they have purchased the lease. Now, they would say, yes, of course, we own it, although they're given no-bid contracts to buy it from off of public land. So, you know, owning is a nebulous prospect at best. You know, this is, the same is true for natural gas, the same is true for oil. When you begin pumping it off public lands, how do you assess the true market value of what's being mined or pumped?
Well, didn't we have a really brave young guy who went into one of these ridiculous auctions and bid on public land and actually wound up getting the government more money, and then they turned around and threw him in jail for 2 years?
Right, right.
Do you remember his name?
it's a closed club. I mean, you know,
what was this kid's name? Because I really want to.
I don't know. I do recall reading the.
All right, I'll look it up on the internet.
The reports on that.
Go ahead.
But it's. I mean, it even gets to such extremes as in the 1920s when oil was selling at below profitable rates. The U.S. government and the state of Texas stepped in and actually brought in the Texas Rangers and arrested anybody who was not one of the large oil companies who was selling oil. And they did this for a number of years until the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that all of these actions were completely unconstitutional and
not
illegal.
Not this Supreme Court, not the John Roberts Supreme
Court. No, this was in the 1920s. No.
Oh.
No, they were much more progressive then. I mean,
well, actually,
just...
no, in the 20s they weren't so much more progressive. They weren't until the 30s when Franklin Roosevelt started appointing some liberals to the court.
Surprised if the 20s was not more progressive than the current court.
Yeah,
as well.
I guess you're right. Yeah, you couldn't have invented them. Back then they actually cared about the law a little bit. Now Scalia and Alito and Thomas and Roberts, all they care about is the latest dictum from the corporations. The young man who went in and bid on public lands, by the way, a really great young activist, was named Tim DeChristopher. Tim, and then D, capital D-E, capital C-H. R-I-S-T-O-P-H-E-R. He bid on intervened in a public auction from oil and to trying to save public lands from oil and gas companies, and they threw him in jail. And I think he's just doing a 2-year sentence now. So I want to make sure that Tim's a great activist. I want to make sure people knew about him.
Yeah, and when we talk about the extremes that the corporatization of these extractions have gone to, I was just reading about there's a Mars exploration going on, and there is an international treaty that says no country can own any extra, off-planetary bodies.
Extraterrestrial,
yes, although the U.S. now has stepped in to argue that that does not apply to corporations.
What?
And that corporations can, under the U.S. interpretation, own extraterrestrial bodies and extract the minerals and the rights. So I think
but
we're going to find.
Can't, but since corporations are people and corporations, then they can.
Apparently so.
All right. We'll go along with that. We're talking with Jay Warmke, author of When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbines. He and his wife, Annie, who are on the phone here, are co-founders of Blue Rock Station, an environmentally oriented center in southeastern Ohio near the bustling metropolis of Zanesville. Annie, what is your role at Blue Rock Station?
Okay, well, her role at this second is, as she's picking up the phone, is cutting peaches. Here she is.
Oh. Hello, how are
Hi,
you today?
Annie, you're canning peaches?
No, actually, I do some canning, but I'm freezing them because if you can freeze food, it's still in its raw state, so it's much healthier, and so we can use it for anything. We can always make jam in the winter when it's cooler and the wood stove's going, and so it just makes more sense to stick everything in the freezer.
Oh, so you just take it off the tree and put it in the freezer?
Well, they have to be cut up. They get washed off and cut up and put in a bag, and then they're in the freezer, and then it's a fabulous food for smoothies or making jam or sauce for Jay's wonderful gluten-free waffles or whatever. It's there for the taking.
Well, good for you. I hope you'll save some for the for Matt and the staff over there at the PRN-FM so that we
Well, you need to come for his breakfast waffles sometime. There's
I will, actually. I'm in Columbus, so you're about 70 miles from me, right?
Yeah, an hour and a half, all the way to heaven if you get here.
There was a piece of heaven in Ohio, but I guess you're right.
We always say we're the Florida of Ohio because people will always say, oh, it's so much nicer here. And we say, well, Florida's not that nice, but Northerners love Florida, so we're good.
Okay, so Annie, I'm looking at your website here, BlueRockStation.com, and I'm seeing a house that looks like a hobbit house. You and Jay did you build this by hand? How did you get the Blue Rock Station going?
Well, I'm not sure which building you're looking at. It could be the Chicken Chalet. Oh, the Earthship.
The Chicken Chalet?
Yeah, we have a Chicken Chalet. Nothing but the best for our hens. It's in there under cool buildings, in the cool buildings section. And it definitely looks like a hobbit house because it has a vaulted ceiling and it's pretty cool. But you're talking about the main house? Is that what you're...
Well, I don't know. I can't tell. Right now I'm looking at
Are there lots of windows on the front?
Looks like a llama. Do you have llamas there?
We do have llamas. Everybody has a job here, and the llamas have a job, and the chickens and the goats and...
All right, let's go over this Marxist labor function here. What is the job of the llamas?
Well, let me just say that in terms of how we see what we do is that we're just one cog in the wheel of this country and this world and this universe. And so our job is to do the best we can to manage the resources we have. And so we need other partners in this job. And one of them is llamas. And their main function...
Now, this is not the Dalai Lama. These are
no, that would be exciting, though, wouldn't it? But no, not the Dalai Lama.
Okay.
These are llamas from the camelid family, and they're here. They have several jobs that are pretty important. One is that they guard the goats and the chickens.
The goats from whom?
They guard them from things like foxes and coyotes and so forth, and they have the ability to stomp and kill something, which they have done in the past.
Like who? Who have they killed?
Well, no humans have been killed. That's the good news. But they've killed a skunk that was trying to get into the hen house.
Wow, really?
And right now they've been very helpful because we've had a big raccoon infestation because they're logging down the road earlier in the spring. And the llamas were brought in to be around the chicken house, and... we haven't had any more hens killed, so that's really good. They also have, I know this is funny, but they have the perfect poop. And in this world...
Wait, the perfect poop?
Poop, yeah, and I'm going to explain that in a second.
Can we say that on the radio, poop?
Yeah, well, I didn't say...
Okay, all right, that's fine.
I didn't say the other words that I normally would choose. Anyway,
so
they have this
perfect about their poop?
Well, it's perfect.
Use it in soup?
Well, we do teach people how to make a plant tea with the poop. Because it's a perfect balance of nitrogen and potassium and phosphorus. And people from all over the country buy it from us by the gallon. And then they can soak a pint of it in a gallon of water and make a tea for their plants that will feed the plants and not burn them. So, but the other thing is that we collect poop from everything because we are not doing a good job of replenishing the soil in this world. So, creating compost, which we do with everything that's compostable here at Blue Rock Station, helps us to create a lot of really great dirt. And the llamas help with that. And then their third job is that they people love to come and have time with them, so they come and take some lessons on how to manage llamas and their health and everything, and then they go for a hike in the woods and have a picnic. And this is a great way for people to experience the true effects of conservation, whereas they might not normally come here because they care about learning about the buildings. They just really like the idea of animals and connecting with them. So everybody has a job, and it's super important. You know, if you don't have a job, a lot of times it's just hard to get through life, and animals are the same as humans in that regard. So that's what we do. And we have goats, and they're terrific. I love working with goats. And
all right, so what do you do with the goats? Do you milk them?
We do have milk from goats, so we can make things like cottage cheese and cheeses and kefir and yogurt. Goat milk has tremendous health for humans. And then they also provide us with kids, so we have more goats or we can sell them to people. And we have one goat, he was born in the spring and he's been taught to be a pack goat, so he can go with the llamas and haul a pack. He's so adorable.
The llamas haul packs too, I assume.
Yes, they do. The picnic that goes to the woods. They can haul quite a lot of weight, so they can haul things for us, if we need them down into the woods. But
can
mainly
people
they
ride
haul
them?
The picnic.
Are the llamas big enough to ride?
No, and they would be quite insulted by that behavior because I think they look at humans and say, you're perfectly capable of walking. Why aren't you? So,
do they lead meditation classes, these llamas?
I suppose they could. I'm sure of it.
How many do you have? How many llamas do you have?
We have five llamas. And then we also have chickens, which are terrific. So if you have milk and eggs, you can make just about anything delicious.
And then what do you do? Do you slaughter the chickens?
No, we take them to a butcher in Baltic to be butchered, but we don't butcher the hens. We only butcher the roosters when there are too many, and about half of all the hens' eggs that are hatched are roosters. So when they get a certain age, they all go to rooster heaven, as we say. So first they go to purgatory, where they have to wait because their behavior is so bad, and then they go to rooster heaven. So.
Huh. Do they have male drumming sessions before you take them away?
No, although I will say some of our friends have come if we needed to butcher one or two. I'm not the butcher. I'm not capable of killing anything. But they've done a little ceremony over them and things because a lot of people have a hard time with that, including me. So I would prefer not to.
You're a vegan, right? You don't
eat meat. I'm not a vegan. I have been vegetarian since I was young, but... due to some health issues lately, I have occasionally, I'll tell myself it's been a month and I haven't had any bite of meat, so I'll have some chicken. And I should mark it on the calendar so I can prove to people that's how I eat meat. But I'm respectful of people that feel like they have to have meat to be healthy. I just object to the fact that if it's the center of the meal, every meal or every day. Because if you want to conserve water, you know, the government says fix those drippy faucets, but the reality is it takes between 1,500 and 5,000 gallons of water to produce 1 pound of beef. And those statistics range from the the folks who produce meat to the people who are against the production of it, but 1,500 gallons is a lot of water for 1 pound of food for somebody. So
yes, and that meat is the number, as best as I can tell, is the number two cause of global warming. The industrial production of meat is number two cause of global warming behind the fossil fuel industry.
Well, the quandary for me personally, and I would expect this could be for anybody who lives on a farm, and maybe even urban people too, but is what do we do with the animals that cannot be, that have to be culled for whatever the reason? There should be humane treatment and honoring of their work and their purpose, and then if people are eating them in an honorable and honest way, I don't see what we do with them otherwise. I definitely have taken animals out that have died so that the birds, the crows, and the vultures can eat them, so they at least have some purpose. But this is just a fact of the real world, you know, the real natural world. And that's one of the great things about where we are, is that we get to experience that natural world every single day. And we find more and more that people come here for workshops or when we have our open house, because they're looking for something. And it's beyond just the 9-to-5 job. Especially young people are really interested in having learning skills that are applicable to life versus just getting an education. And we see this all the time. And we're so fortunate to have young people come here a lot, and also to live with us throughout the warm months. But they're just looking for something. People have a longing, and we feel like it's just this connection that this wonderful connection that we get to have every day here.
Now, you were talking with Annie Warmke and Jay Warmke of Blue Rock Station in near Zanesville, Ohio. Jay is the author of When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine, which we'll be talking about a little more. I reviewed it. It's at freepress.org, commondreams.org, and Huffington Post. We're going to take a short break now with the Soratopia song from Dana Lyons, and we'll be back in a couple minutes to talk more about fossil fuels. Thank you, Annie and Jay, for being with us, and stay on the line, please. Indeed, that's the future for me. It's also the present. We're talking, that was Dana Lyons of Cows with Guns fame, singing the Soratopia song, the Rocky Top version. We're talking with Jay and Ann Warmke of Blue Rock Station in New Zanesville, Ohio. how would you characterize this community, Jay and Annie? I was going to call it something, but what is it?
Well, we're a sustainable living farm, but we have a huge array of people around the world who are interested in the same thing. So I guess it's a worldwide community is how I would say it. And one of the things that I think that sets us apart from a lot of other folks who are interested in living more sustainably, which we define as trying not to take away from the future, is that we've got what we call the happiness factor. And we're keenly interested in the idea of what does it take to really have a high happiness factor and still live in a country like the United States of America. And one of the things that we've started doing is in the month of January, we have what we call Thanks for Nothing Month, and we live without using energy or money, because money is quite a tool to put between you and other people. And the books that we write, we hope have a lot of happiness, and of course Jay has a terrific sense of humor. And I was thinking, when you first started talking about how hopeless it can all feel when we start focusing on all the things of how we're so different and all the problems, but if we focus on what we have in common, that changes a lot of things in life, and it creates a really terrific sense of we can move on and have every day be something really good. Wouldn't you say, Jay?
Well, yeah, I mean, as Annie was saying with the Thanks for Nothing Month, it helped me specifically, because I think I may be a little more embedded in the world here that we all live in than Annie, as she always likes to say that when she leaves Blue Rock Station, she's entering a world that she just can't wait to get out of when she comes back here. But it made me feel more in tune with consumption and what that does with us. And whether that's the consumption of energy or the consumption of money. And I think it sort of pointed out to me in a very secular way why so many religions around the world have a period of time, usually about a month, where you sit and reflect and deny yourself something during that period of time, so that I think it brings home, you know, that kind of sense of being aware of what you're consuming and being aware of what you're doing.
All right. Well, let's talk about hi there. Let's talk about your book now, Jay. I do want to come visit.
I thought you were going to ask me about my Naturally Healthy Goats book, Harvey.
Tell me about your Naturally Healthy Goats.
Well,
is it goat or ghost?
Even though that might sound silly, the truth is that we live in a world just filled with chemicals and a medical model that includes animals and certainly livestock. And so a couple years ago, Hager Goat Supply asked me if I'd be interested in writing a book about some of the practices that we use here, where we use herbs and other foods and things like that for our critters, and how we're able to get past some of the parasite issues that kill goats normally, and this has been a super bad year for it. So anyway, that's my plug for my book. But
I hated to interrupt, but I thought,
hey, listen, you got to ask me. This is important stuff.
Well, tell me the title of this book.
Called Naturally Healthy Goats Reference Guide. And it's
Naturally Healthy Goats.
Great,
and,
yes.
And by Annie or Ann?
Annie. Annie Warmke.
Okay, I have a daughter named Annie.
Many years ago. She's adorable. You're a rich man.
Yes, I am. And she now has my first biological grandchild.
Oh. But
unfortunately, they live in Los Angeles, so.
Oh, that's
we'll
terrible.
Yeah.
So okay. I'll turn it back over to Jay so he can.
Well,
talk
I want
about...
to come visit you. Do people come to you every day? What are the?
No, no, that would make us crazy. Because scarcity is something that makes us want things more, and so we're very happy when we have visitors, but not every single day. And it also makes people want to come because they can't come every day. So during the warm months, we have one afternoon a month, generally on a Saturday at 1 o'clock, and people can see all that information on our website at BlueRockStation.com. And then we also have workshops where we do tours, and then we open up our home, five or six times a year for bus tours. And then we also do some things like with the Organic Farm Association called OFA, where we open up once a year in the summertime to have a tour to support their efforts. And but if we had people coming every day, we wouldn't be happy, genuinely happy to see them. So we want to live in a world where people genuinely care about each other. So.
All right, that sounds good, Annie Warmke. Visits the Blue Rock Station. Got to go to the website and make sure that you know when to come.
Right, and now you can see why Annie does all of our marketing, since she shamelessly promotes everything.
Absolutely. Well, no, she's done a great job. Very, very good.
Thank you.
Let's see, Jay, if you're as good. So let's talk about your book here.
It is a competition, you know.
All right.
When the biomass hits the wind turbine, what is the basic theme of this excellent book that I've reviewed? It's very funny, very engaging.
Well, and
about
I think
the renewable, it's really about Solartopia, about the dawn of a new Solartopian age. So tell us, Jay, what prompted you to write it, and give us the basic core of its meaning.
Sure, and I guess at its very base, as I was writing it, as I was researching all of the energy issues, that REM song kept running through my head, that it's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine. And it really was amazing to me as I studied all of the data coming from the government and all of the various corporations, how clear clearly we were at a tipping point. You know, we're at this moment when the world of fossil fuels comes to an end and something new is taking its place. And it struck me these things happen only, you know, once a century or so, where, for instance, a similar time would have been the Industrial Revolution, or the change from steam to oil. And we are in this transition period where fossil fuels are simply and inevitably running out. And as I was looking at this...
Well, thankfully. Otherwise,
yes,
we'd completely
truly,
destroy the planet, which we've almost done anyway.
Right. And we are engaged in a number of technologies of desperation, trying to hold on to this world of fossil fuels. And we mentioned a few, like horizontal fracking of natural gas and mountaintop removal with coal. And, of course, even deep drilling in miles below the Gulf of Mexico, you know, for oil. All of these things are technologies of desperation trying to hang on to something that is inevitably going away. And so there will be those people who view this, and I think the media plays this up quite a lot, of this is coming to an end, there's a threat to our lifestyle, you must be very, very afraid. And the more I kept looking at it, the more I kept thinking, yes, there is a threat to this lifestyle, and thank goodness. Because technology with renewables, such as solar, wind, all of those are coming of age right at the right time. So now what we'll see is this inevitable fight to hang on to a dying way of life. And that fight is going to be mounted by the corporations that profit from this dying way of life. And I think I was talking to someone before, and I think we're going to start seeing the stages of this with renewable energy. I think it was Gandhi who had said, you know, first they ignore you, then they ridicule you, then they attack you, and then they accept you.
Well, he said, then you win.
Well, essentially, we're going through that same stages with renewable energy, where the we were ignored. Renewable energy was ignored. Then we're just a bunch of tree huggers, and now we're moving into this stage of attack. And it's because renewable energy, such as solar and wind, is making serious inroads into the whole world of energy. You know, where, for instance, in Germany just recently, there was one day where more than 50% of their energy needs for that day was supplied through solar. I mean, these are serious impacts on the bottom lines of some large corporations, and they're going to begin to attack. And one example of that I saw was the U.S. Congress Armed Services Committee has just ruled that the military cannot use alternative energy unless they can demonstrate it's cheaper than fossil fuel.
Well, but it is cheaper.
Well, it is, but how do you demonstrate such a thing to a group that doesn't want to hear it? You know, how do you analyze the true costs of something? So I think that's an example, because the military has been an early adopter of renewable energy because they see that it not only saves money, but it saves lives. And they're beginning to get the pushback from...
Well, okay. I mean, basically, 2011 was a turning point in that it was really the first year where you saw the financial journals filling up with articles. I'm talking about Bloomberg's and Fortune the other major serious financial journals acknowledging that renewables are cheaper than nuclear.
Mm-hmm.
General Electric came out and said that within 5 years, photovoltaic cells will be cheaper than coal. So, now we have a situation where this nascent technology, as you point out in your book, is becoming the mainstream. And it's the fossil and nuclear fuels, or what I call King Kong, coal, oil, nukes, and gas, that has become the alternative, and because it's so much more expensive and it's unsustainable.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when the biomass hits the wind turbine, you trace some of the history. Can you give us some of the key moments in the history of renewables that might be worth talking about now?
Well, in the history of renewables, I think one thing to bear in mind is essentially the photovoltaic industry is only about 10 years old. You know, it's been around longer than that, clearly, from the Apollo space program was its early days. But as a true industry with things to sell to the general public, we're looking at an industry that's only about, you know, a decade old. It's still a child. And I like to compare the adoption of photovoltaics or solar power to the adoption of the mobile telephone, because the first mobile telephone was offered to the general public in 1984, I believe. And as of today, of the 7 million people on the planet, 6 million people own a mobile telephone.
You're kidding.
No, it's actually...
You mean billion?
I'm sorry, 6 billion people, yes.
6 billion people own cell phones?
Yes, it is the most ubiquitous technology in the world. And actually in the United States, a child under the age of 12 is 14% more likely to own a mobile telephone than to own a book.
Oh, God.
So welcome to the brave new world, you know. I mean, so
well,
this is
so unfortunately, I mean, cell phones have serious health implications, which have barely been dealt with.
Sure, but it also demonstrates how quickly a technology can be adopted when it's out there and when it's inexpensive enough and has demonstrated benefits. The demonstrated benefits there is that you're able to call a person rather than a location. So what we're seeing with photovoltaics is really 2012-2013 is the year when solar power became cheaper than buying your electricity from the utility company. And every other comparison is a false comparison when you talk about retail electricity.
Well, why is that? Tell us why.
Well, it's because people like to say coal is cheaper or natural gas is cheaper, but the average person can't go out and buy a coal power plant.
Thank God.
Yes, I know. But they can go out and buy a photovoltaic system. So they have two choices. They can buy electricity from the utility company, or they can, you know, install their own solar array on their house.
Well, is this true everywhere?
No, it's regional, but on average, you're looking at where the most expensive electricity that you can purchase is the electricity from your power company. So once people begin to realize this and companies begin to take advantage of it, and these are going to be big playing companies such as Google and Facebook and, you know, the technology companies who are going to come and suddenly be energy players. And suddenly this whole industry transforms, and it transforms quickly, just as we saw with mobile telephones. So one thing I like to say is that your utility company in the future is going to look a lot more like Facebook than it's going to look like First Energy or AEP.
How? How's that?
Well, because these are going to be social networks selling virtual items as opposed to large companies with large infrastructures. I'll give you an example. Let's say you were to go out and build a solar array on your home. Currently, you can only sell it to one customer, which is your power company. And they have to pay you, if they fall under the guidelines of net metering, they have to pay you the same cost, retail cost, that you pay them. So if you produce more power than you're using, you can sell it to them. If you produce less power than you're using, you buy from them, and it all nets out at the end. You just pay the difference. So that's net metering. Well, as more and more people begin to put solar arrays up, you get to a point where these utility companies reach what they consider to be saturation. They already have their own power companies. They don't want to, or power plants. They don't want to be buying from their customers. So they're going to begin to refuse to purchase this, or to look to government to put limits on how much of this solar power they have to purchase. And we already see this happening in California. So that frees you up to sell it to someone else, Well, let's say I decide I want to buy your power because you're generating excess electricity. So now you're not only an electrical customer, you're an electric utility. And as literally millions of people get into the same position that you're in, because I don't have to live next door to you, all we're doing is buying and selling virtual electrons, this suddenly becomes as uncontainable as the internet is. You know, this communication system that's global and virtual is literally outside of the control of any one governmental body because it moves too quickly. And I think we're going to see the same thing in the utility market, where electricity is going to be the communications transition that we saw from Ma Bell to the internet. The same thing's going to happen with utilities here over the next two decades.
So if I'm building a new house somewhere where the sun shines,
yes,
I'm not going to put up wires to the utility company. I'm going to put up solar panels, and I'll get away cheaper.
You probably will also want to connect to the utility company as well, just because that's like your contact to the outer world. That's your port to the internet of electricity.
Yeah, but why would you need it if you can support your own house with solar panels?
Well, because now if you were in a situation where that was your desire, certainly that's an option. But oftentimes people will use the utilities as essentially a giant battery. So if you get a number of days where you can't generate enough power using your solar panels, you can draw from the utility company. And then on the days when you are generating excess power, you sell back to that utility company.
Those wires are ugly, man. I'd just soon do without them.
Well,
although
there's probably better than huge battery banks. Although that gets us into a whole new world when you start talking about electric vehicles and how these distributed electric vehicles can suddenly be the distributed storage system for this electrical grid, where those batteries that you need for battery backup could be the same batteries that are powering your car.
We're talking with Jay Warmke, author of When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine. We talked earlier with his wife Annie about their place in southeastern Ohio, Blue Rock Station. We only have 5 minutes left, amazingly enough. And before we finish up, by the way, I don't want to lose track of this. I went to see Crosby, Stills, Nash last night at Cincinnati in the Riverfront Pavilion there, and they were spectacular. And they're doing a 70-city tour, and I've written a review of the concert, which I'll put up tonight at freepress.org and nukefree.org and a number of other places. So, if you have a chance to catch Crosby, Stills, Nash in your neighborhood, please do. You will really enjoy it. They were spectacular, really transcendent performance by a wonderful, wonderful band. All right, Jay Warmke, you trace in your book the history dating from 1491, I guess. Is that right?
Yes, right.
Columbus coming to America and being found on the beach by Columbus being discovered by the Native Americans on the beach and up to the present. What would you say over time is the most significant development with renewables, and what is it that's really going to change the world more than anything else to save the world, hopefully, from global warming and nuclear power?
Well,
in terms
I think
of this technology.
One of the reasons why I went back that far is I did find that whenever mankind is faced with abundance, we tend to behave like frat boys at an open bar, and we can
consume
it until it's all gone. So we went through this. One of the reasons the New World was so important to Europe was essentially Europe had cut down all of the trees across Europe, and the United States represented, well, not the United States at that time, represented a source of power, source of energy in the form of trees. And what we find is each epoch seems to run that same course of we have abundance, and then we use it up, and then we have to replace it with something else that appears to be in abundance until we use that up, whether it's charcoal or whale oil or kerosene or petroleum, fossil fuels. And I think we're going to be faced with the same thing with renewable energy. the hopeful thing with renewable energy is that all of the fossil fuels in ever stored on this planet represent about 3 days of stored sunlight. So what we have consumed in the last 150 years is essentially 1.5 days of sunlight. So when, as we begin to harness the amazing amount of energy that's out there with sunlight, you know, we're going to find ourselves facing a future of almost unlimited possibilities. The cautionary tale there, though, is I think the big issue we're going to be faced with is as we transition out of the age of fossil fuels into this renewable energy age, is how to deal with this abundance. And I think this abundance of free energy, which is essentially where this all leads to, is probably going to cause more problems than it solves.
All right, well, that's a problem we're going to be glad to face. But what are the technologies in the interim to get us off fossil and nuclear power that are going to be most useful?
Oh, there's a million of them. But, of course, wind is really taking up the slack as far as utility-scale energy. Photovoltaic is going to take up personal energy sources. But then those who live along the coast have coastal energy, the power of waves, the power of tides. The one thing that has become clear to me is energy in its various forms, renewable energy, is the one thing this planet has in absolute abundance.
And the one thing we're out of now is time. Thank you so much, Jay Warmke, author of When the Biofuels Hit the Wind Turbine. Thank you, Annie Warnke, for talking to us about Blue Rock Station. Next week, we will have Greg Powers with us for two successive shows, talking about things as only Greg Powers can do. Stick with us in the coming weeks with the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Thank you to the crew of PRN-FM. And we will see you next week on the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show.
Solartopia, don't you know we're going to have a Solartopia.